C-K-K-U-T-T 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade. This spring marks the 10-year anniversary of one of the most powerful waves of student-led protests in Quebec and Canadian history. In 2012, a student strike protesting an increase in tuition escalated into a widespread protest movement that threatened the social peace and included nightly illegal street demonstrations, property destruction both clandestine and open, riots and demonstrations in cities across Quebec, clashes with police, supportive community protests in neighborhoods around Montreal and beyond, and the passing and repealing of an unprecedented special law designed to criminalize street protest and regain police control of the streets. It wasn't the first student strike in Quebec history, and it likely won't be the last, in part due to a labor law-like system of student representation that codifies students as a constituency capable of unionizing, negotiating, and striking. But that's not the only reason this happened. In many contexts around the world, university and college campuses are a place where young activists get started, become radicalized, and find one another. Student protests and occupations often spread out into the world beyond the campus gates, just as they did in Quebec in 2012. Personally, I attended university in the mid-2000s and was in the streets as a student during a less explosive but still very formative student strike in 2005. I spent a lot of time articulating demands such as free tuition, student-run education, and the removal of corporate governance structures from educational institutions. During my time at university, however, I came to see the university itself as an irredeemable institution of power that should be abolished rather than reformed. Despite that position, which I do still personally hold, I can't deny that the 5 or more years I spent on campus were extremely formative for me. I learned how to organize, how to find and build affinity with fellow travelers, how to plan events and protests and occupations, how to write and articulate my ideas, and basically every other skill I use today as an anarchist during those years. None of that learning took place in the classroom or through university-sanctioned activities of any kind. This year, I noticed news coming out about a wave of student occupations at McGill University, the elite Anglophone rich white man school where I did my own undergraduate years. As I read through their demands and manifestos, I was struck by the similarities with much of what I did myself there in my early 20s. I reached out to 2 of the young organizers there to chat about what the occupations mean to them, how they got started, and what they hope to achieve by taking up space on their campus, in this case to demand that the school divest from the fossil fuel industry. We chatted about their campaign, the recent occupations, and what it's been like organizing on campus this year. The interview made me think a lot about student movements, about what is so special about those spaces where young people in their teens and 20s come together, and how we might engage with them and honor their indisputable contribution to radical social movements in many cities. Here is my interview with Mos and Andre, 2 student organizers with Divest McGill, a student group demanding that the university divest from the fossil fuels industry. They recently organized a 2-week occupation of a university building. The occupation brought students, workers, and community members together out in the open after more than a year of online school, social distancing, and widespread isolation. Here is that conversation.
For those who don't know, can you explain a little bit what kind of institution McGill University is?
Sure. So McGill is one of the largest universities, I suppose, in so-called Canada, and one of the oldest. So, you know, University of British Columbia is also like one of the better known universities in Canada. So that actually started as a satellite campus of McGill, for example. So it's relatively old, relatively prestigious, whatever that means, institution. And this, you know, has consequences for the size of its endowment. It's relatively large compared to you know, smaller universities, and as well. It also means that, you know, it has the typical governance structure that you expect from these large kind of research-focused academic institutions, which is, you know, kind of what we're seeing is them being operated more and more like a corporation as it comes to it.
It's a university that was founded in the name of James McGill. He is someone who enslaved a lot of Indigenous and Black folks, and the university... as it currently operates in the province of Quebec, is very violent towards Indigenous and Black people. They've refused for years to remove the statue of James McGill that was at the entrance of the main campus. It took them forever to change the name of the sport team that was originally an anti-Indigenous slur. And the percentage of Black scholars at the school is really minimal. And so that, I guess, heritage from the name is very much ongoing. So that's a little bit more background on who they are. And they're operating on the stolen land of the Ganyagihaga, which is a member of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and is the Indigenous nation that's most present, although there are other Indigenous nations in the area.
And how did you each get into radical politics or student politics? Like, what brought you there?
I was involved at most of my schools since I was very young. And it's sort of, the involvement sort of shifted through the time from maybe student life to more politics and then more radical politics. So I was involved in a lot of projects for student life, things like this yearbook or concerts and variety shows when I was in elementary and in high school. And then midway through high school, I began to get involved in more queer organizing. There was an ally committee at my high school. It was mostly queer folks, but open to everyone. And we would do different projects to counter homophobia, transphobia at the school. And then I also began to get involved with the student newspaper and cover different things that were happening in the city, but also organizing on campus. And in my second to last year of high school, I have a family member who lives in the States and was a victim of police brutality. Went pretty close from dying, but hopefully survived. And so I got very involved in the Black Lives Matter movement in my last year of high school, sort of as a way to process that experience and that family trauma. And that was first very localized at the school. So I was doing a lot of awareness work in classes and giving presentations and trying to get curriculums for different classes to speak about the movement, speak about racial justice. And through that project, I got many connections outside of the school with people who were doing that work in the city and sort of invited me in to keep doing that work after I graduated from high school. And as far as climate justice organizing, which is what we're mostly talking about with Divest, I joined the group in 2019. I had already been involved in a few environmental groups, but I was feeling dissatisfied with the approach, which was often very focused on changing people's lifestyles and explaining how to compost and giving very useful tools, but that were very focused on the individual level, which to me was not enough, and sort of created this false sense of culpability in people when we know that corporations are the ones that are polluting the most and that have been trying to hide the crisis for decades. And so I was trying to find a way to bring it further than the individual level. And when I learned about Divest, I was just really happy. I was like, okay, that is it. And the folks here are just really great. So it's been, I've been having a good time organizing and learning with them.
And then for me, some of the early things that I can kind of pinpoint are, like, you know, I would go to marches and things. In particular, one that sticks out to me is being from so-called Lower Mainland. I went to the 2018 March on Burnaby Mountain against Trans Mountain, and that had been, like, you know, like a huge march, and I remember feeling kind of like that sense of collective power, and just kind of really enjoyed it. Of course, you know, as marches go, not all that much came of it, but you know, that being kind of my early entry into, you know, I guess kind of like radical resistance in some form, was a powerful thing. And then when I came later to Jojage, and took part in the 2019 September 27th climate march, which had 500,000 people out in the street, there was once again that really sent that real sense of, I guess, sort of collective power, in the way that, you know, when you're in a crowd of 500,000 people, you really feel like you can do anything. If the people were organized to do something, they could. Of course, there was the same sort of sense afterwards of, you know, now what, and not all that much kind of happening of it, happening from it. And then, so it's kind of after that I started to get involved more directly with groups like Divest. And yeah, similarly, it was just kind of a helpful thing to actually, you know, feel connected with folks that were also kind of interested in doing something beyond just marching, and perhaps like having a bit of a strategy or a praxis that was directed.
And why have you chosen divestment in particular as a strategy? What is it about that that speaks to you?
I think beyond that framing that I was talking about of not only looking at individual acts, but looking at corporations, I think the main point of divestment is to take power away from the fossil fuel industry. It is an industry that is causing a lot of harms to many communities and many forms of life on this planet, and has sort of been left unaccountable in the past. Oftentimes our projects go through, if not all time, but to unceded land, and will go through indigenous communities and cause not only, you know, dangers related to spills, because all pipelines eventually spill, but there's a lot of violence, physical violence that comes with those pipelines, either through the criminalization of the people who are on the front lines and resisting the construction, or because of the implementation of man camps, worker camps, to build the pipelines, where it's mostly men from other communities that are coming to work for a short period of time and make a lot of money and don't have much to do when they're not working. And we see higher rates of murders of Indigenous women and higher rates of disappearances. And to me, stopping that implies taking power away from them, because right now they have a lot of control over politics. They get a lot of support from many, many politicians. And it is through taking that power away that we can sort of begin to transition to a more just world. I believe in a world where all forms of life and all lives are celebrated and are cared for.
Divestment in like the kind of beginnings of the decade was largely focused around kind of this idea of taking power away from the fossil fuel industry, specifically by, you know, sending a message of revoking social license when institutions are saying we aren't going to make investments in fossil fuels anymore. That gives a certain level of stigma to the industry. And so stopping that power, I entirely agree, is entirely important. And, you know, something that's emerged in the past few years, along with sort of the solidarity lens of, you know, doing this as a large motivator of doing this sort of work being in solidarity with Indigenous folks and the violence, colonial violence that they're facing through fossil fuel industry activities. So alongside that, what's emerged is the idea that, you know, it's not just purely a symbolic thing to be taking away the fossil fuel industry's social license, but it also is significant sums of capital that we're dealing with. And so, you know, for many years it's been talked about that, you know, divestment isn't quite a financial thing, it's a symbolic thing. Now it's been re-entering the conversation that, you know, if we are able to grab hold of this capital, then we can try and reinvest it in kind of just community-centered projects. And kind of the idea being that it's not just the fossil fuel industry whose power we're trying to cut off, but an entire extractive economy. And what we want to do is kind of starve the power and capital, starve the power of this extractive economy, and try and redirect it to projects that will characterize or help grow a regenerative economy. And you know, this can, for me, this very much takes in an anti-capitalist lens. You know, starving extractive capitalism and kind of bringing us towards something that is more reparative and community centered, and I keep saying the word regenerative, but it's a good one for me. And a lot of the words and work that I'm kind of bending about here come from the Just Transition Framework, which is a framework by Climate Justice Alliance and specifically Movement Generation that kind of deals with this whole idea of moving from an extractive economy to a regenerative one, what that sort of takes on its sort of forms, as well as kind of what, you know, false solutions there are to avoid.
Okay. I mentioned this when we were conversing before this interview, but like, I went to McGill more than 15 years ago and was a student organizer there. I would say that most people believed in climate change, but it wouldn't have necessarily been the issue that would have gotten a lot of people out to an action or an occupation. Do you feel like McGill students care about colonialism or about climate change? Like, are these issues that are important to a lot of your fellow students right now?
I would say yes. I think the challenge we're facing most of the time is not that people don't care, is that people don't necessarily feel empowered to act. And when they are given ways, they usually show up. So we've gotten a lot of support. I've been here for 3 years, so I started in 2019. And 2019, 2020, and 2021, 2022, so this academic year and 2 years ago, I remember, like, every divest action I would go to, there were always a lot of people. There were people that were coming every time that weren't necessarily part of the core organizing group, but whenever they would see something posted by Divest, an invitation to come to an action, they would be there. I think the pandemic has made it hard because a lot of people, well, were not on campus. Last year was fully online. A lot of people were also not in the city, even in our core group. And that made it harder to build connections within the group and also recruit new members, because every year there are people who graduate and might still do work around climate justice, hopefully, but oftentimes that will be with other groups, although some stay in contact with Divest. And so last year was very hard. At some point during the year, I think the core group was down to 5 people. And then we started this year and held a sort of public brunch and mobilizing meeting. And I think we were something like 30 people. And just that switch from the 5 people of mine to 30 people coming, like showing up in a park, bringing muffins to share with everyone, and then eating at a socially distanced, like safe way. But yeah, it was just very, very exciting to see. So I do think there is a lot of support. I think what we also struggle with, but we've been pretty good at solving that challenge, is making sure that new students that are coming in are like as informed as students that have been at the school for a longer period of time, because the pandemic created that sort of break where if you weren't already following the group, then you wouldn't really know about them because you weren't on campus and would not see them. And so there was a lot of work done in the fall, and then more recently, we're probably going to talk about it, just to be very visible and sort of get people more engaged.
You guys are also, you're not just talking about divestment, you're also talking about democratizing the university, changing the structure of the university. Can you talk a little bit about that demand and why it's important to you, like what it means and what it would look like to make that change at McGill?
Sure, definitely. So as was mentioned, Divest started at McGill in 2012. And interestingly, it actually first started as decorporatized McGill as a broader sort of lens, and then it kind of narrowed its focus specifically to divestment. And this is as kind of, you know, the 350.org wave of starting divestment movements at universities was kind of picking up. But so over this last 10 years, we've tried kind of a diversity of tactics targeting McGill's Board of Governors, which is the body that makes the decisions on investments. And, you know, we've submitted several, you know, reports, expressions of concerns. We've had, you know, different sorts of occupations and protests. But, you know, each time that it comes to the question, and it's been 3 times now, it's refused by the Board of Governors, and specifically by the Committee Advising on Matters of Social Responsibility, which is, you know, the board as a whole is a highly undemocratic, overwhelmingly corporate body. And the chair of that committee that I mentioned that advises on matters of social responsibility is actually a former executive of Petro-Canada who worked there for 18 years. And there's all sorts of these kind of just corporate lines of power, I suppose, that are concentrated all over the board. And so the last kind of rejection of divestment, or the last consideration of the question, I suppose, came through the McGill Senate, where it was proposed by Professor Greg Mickelson in a motion, which passed in the Senate, which, you know, is the highest academic body of the university and is, you know, theoretically supposed to be kind of somewhat equal in power to the Board of Governors. In this case, it very much was not, and that decision was, you know, unilaterally quashed by the board. And Professor Greg Mickelson actually resigned after this decision from his tenured position. And he'd been an ally with Divest for many years, but after his resignation, what he said is that in order to divest McGill, we must democratize McGill. And sort of that is sort of a framing that we have been taking forward. The idea that, yeah, McGill is not a democratic institution, and we are far from the only, you know, advocacy group, let alone group or individual, that's been facing all these grievances with the university. And also the idea being that, you know, McGill also used to invest in South African apartheid, in tobacco, in all of these things that took, you know, long divestment campaigns for them to divest from. And for me, you know, it's interesting to think about if the university and its resources were controlled democratically, then, you know, the need for these long campaigns and this kind of drain of energy and capacity would be kind of obviated by the idea that, you know, the people collectively could actually decide to invest in what's actually regenerative. And this is taking the standpoint of just investments, but then extending this to kind of all operations of the university, imagining what a democratized structure that is actually sensitive and connected with the needs of people that, you know, actually are ever on campus, or kind of affected by McGill as an institution in the community and in whatever way, whether it's students, academic staff and profs, or non-academic staff, or just members of the community of so-called Montreal, where McGill has, you know, over decades or centuries just siphoned wealth from its surroundings.
And gentrified.
And
in neighborhoods in which it operates.
Exactly. Yeah, so what a regenerative, democratized university could look like is just a very interesting and inspiring thing to imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're kind of hitting on an important question there, which is to make McGill something that was accountable to people who are affected by McGill would mean obviously including people who aren't even students. You know, like often we talk about student power and how like you guys don't have a lot of say in how the university is run, but people who were like previously living in the Milton Park neighborhood who can't live there anymore, Indigenous people who lived in that land, people who like can't afford to go to McGill, obviously are like not a part of that. Do you think like a democratic McGill would change who does and doesn't end up at McGill? Like, would it be a different institution entirely?
That's what we hope. That's definitely what we hope. And I think one point that came up often in the assemblies that we've been hosting, so to give a little bit of context, as we were working through that question of democratization, we joined up with other groups on campus, mostly student groups, but we're currently building relations with unions as well, worker unions. And we formed a coalition called Democratize McGill, which it sort of holds these goals of democratizing the school and has been doing work to achieve it. And so we've hosted three assemblies now through that coalition. And during the assemblies, people are invited to talk about different problems they're facing at the school, what solutions they could see to those problems, and how is the current governance system either creating the problems or making it difficult to get solutions, and how could it be different? So that's sort of the broad questions, but then we split up in different groups. And one idea that has been coming over and over again is free tuition. An idea that was very much central in the 2012 student protests at the time where our group emerged. So it makes a lot of sense for us at Divest to talk about this. And that's something that a lot of students have been bringing up as something that should be part of this new democratic school, because then more students would be able to come and study here. But what you're saying is very important. This goes beyond divestment. This goes beyond student politics. Democratization is about everyone who makes up the McGill community and everyone who's affected by it. And so for workers, it's also very essential. A lot of workers throughout the pandemic have seen their rights completely like disregarded by the administration of the school. We were talking recently with the porters at the school, and they were telling us right now they're doing the equivalent of like three people's job, like each individually, and their working conditions have not changed at all. And our profs are actually not unionized. It's the only university in this province where profs are not unionized. The McGill Law profs are currently trying to unionize and get a somewhat more equal power dynamic with the administration of the school, and McGill is actually taking them to court, to the labor tribunal, saying that that the unit is not representative and that it should be all the profs of the entire school or no profs at all who are unionized. So we're really hoping that they get the accreditation from the tribunal, that the tribunal rejects the argument that McGill is making. But all that to say, like, all of these groups are very much impacted by the current governance system. And I think a lot of them would feel safer at the school and would have a better experience working, living, or studying there, were their voices more central in decision making. And that includes, as you were saying, the people from the Milton Park community, the people from Saint-Anne-de-Bellevue, which is the other sort of area where McGill also has a campus. All of these people also deserve their say in what McGill does, because it affects their quality of life as well.
I've read through some of your, like, your manifesto and some of your documentation. Some of what you're asking for is actually quite expansive, you know, that education should be liberating. It shouldn't be like a diploma factory. It shouldn't be just like an assembly line where students are there to, like, buy a product, and that it should be run by the people who are affected by it. Like, none of this is simple, right? Like, the Board of Governors is not going to simply abolish itself. The school itself is an elite school. People go there, like, to pay for that branded diploma, right? Like, it has, like, a long history as an institution of that kind. How do you imagine getting from here to there? Like, what's your sense of trajectory?
So what's been mentioned so far is that, you know, a phase that we're in kind of at the moment is just trying to hear from as many different sort of constituencies at the university as possible, and vision you know, what a university or educational institution without all these grievances that they're facing would be like, and, you know, what it would feel like to be at a university that actually feels like it's democratic controlled, doesn't feel like it's a colonial force. So I think that's going to need to be something that will really continue. And one interesting thing is that, you know, during this past occupation, which we'll get to, we held some of those assemblies, and towards the last few assemblies, we had a bent towards actually, you know, discussing, you know, these kind of key areas of focus of the current undemocratic institution, and seeing how we can kind of, like, actionably target them. And one thing that's kind of come up over and over again is, of course, the idea of dual power, building up kind of these groups, building up kind of power that's separate from the university, but that, you know, provides what people need from the institution that they aren't getting in some sense, whether in the educational sense or not. And then for me, I kind of think of, you know, building these things up, and to an extent that it obsoletes the existing governance structures at McGill, because they fundamentally just don't stand for the needs of students and staff at the university. And a kind of, like, dual power approach could, like, more effectively respect and respond to those needs. And it's a bit abstract, but, you know, there have been, like, a variety of ideas of, you know, building up, you know, power that targets the endowment by, like, kind of intercepting donations, building up power targeting, you know, McGill's, like, inflow of cash through its cafeteria operations by, like, putting together, like, food justice initiatives, and kind of also on, and, you know, just, like, organizing varieties of folks at the university to gain power.
I think besides that dual power idea, two other points that have been pretty central in how we've been currently thinking about it is, first of all, decentralization of power and sort of breaking down the question, right? Because you make a very good point in saying this is very broad. So we're looking at each aspect separately and keeping the end goal in mind. So for example, we've been looking at classrooms and how to democratize classrooms. And we want to sort of identify and spread back best practices for democratic classrooms. One example being at the university, the Quebec University in Montreal, UQAM, Université du Québec à Montréal. Students get to vote on their syllabus at the beginning of the school year for all of their classes, and vote on evaluations. And if the date of the evaluation, or the format of the evaluation, doesn't respond to their desires, then they have to figure out something different with the prof. So that's one practice, you know, that we can share. And a lot of profs have been doing very collaborative format in their classes. Of course, the extent to which it can be collaborative and the what it will look like in the end depends on the different departments they're operating in. But I think a lot of people have very creative practices, and now like sharing those is what sort of needs to be done. So that's for the aspect of the classroom. We've also been looking at labor in itself and how do we build up the power of the workers. Well, unionization is one of the central points in doing that. And so that's why we're wanting to build relationships with the unions that are currently in place, and also try to mobilize people in solidarity and in support of workers that are trying to unionize and are not already unionized.
We didn't start the fire. It was always burning ever since there have been people trying to stomp on other people. There have been people trying to push them back. And this particular struggle may find its roots in post-war France, where the radicals who fought against the fascist occupation went to school and found a brand new stance. They called it syndicalisme de combat, and they said fuck those old student federations. They collaborate with fascists and they're nothing but reformers serving the interests of the state. Their new student unions built up a student movement, and together with the workers they most famously struck in May 1968. But that struggle in France wasn't miraculously born. Maybe we can trace it back to anarchists and communists who fought Franco in the Spanish Civil War. But they didn't start the fire. It was always burning ever since. There have been people trying to stomp on other people. There have been people trying to push them back. And in Quebec, the youth were getting radical in many different channels and streams. And they came together in a big bad river that flowed out into the streets. It was the 60s and their nation was changing. The liberals came into power. They promised free education and a kind of liberation from conservative traditional ways. But it wasn't enough, and by 66 they were gone. And after May 68 the students felt strong. So some kids occupied the school, kicked out administrative rule, and sparked the first student strike and make a scene. And you might say it was successful, or at least a big deal. They want a freeze on tuition that lasted 22 years. But they didn't stop fighting, and they didn't stop lighting torches to pass on and on. But it wasn't easy. There's always been a divide between those who think this is about turning the tides and those who'd rather win a few measly concessions from the bastards handing out the cards of privilege or oppression. It's never been about just schools and tuition, but throughout history, these movements mostly failed at their mission of uniting the students and the working class. Though more than once they came together and they made quite a splash, but they didn't start the fire. It was always burning ever since. There have been people trying to stomp on other people. There have been people trying to push them back. And we're not the only ones holding torches. We're not the only ones who want to burn down the fortress. All around the world there are people standing up and fighting the fuck back. It's a new age of austerity, which means cuts, cuts, and the fucked get fucked. And governments around the world are clinging to their money, crying crisis to their people. And it isn't even funny that the joke is on the ones who can't afford to laugh, but they're not gonna take it, they're gonna fight back. There was a full-on insurrection in Greece, immigrants, workers, and youth taking to the streets in California. In 2010, there was a motherfucking shitstorm when Schwarzenegger raised tuition by a hell of a lot. But the students all dug in their heels and they fought, they cried, occupy everything and demand nothing. All over the world, students are saying something, from Colombia to Chile to the UK. And the students aren't the only ones who think there's hell to pay. Some people occupied the Capitol in Wisconsin. And then that Arab Spring, it was really something. Public squares were occupied by indignados in Spain, and in North America, Occupy did the same. And you might say it's just glorified political camping, but it gets harder to deny that there's something happening with every passing day as the stakes get raised and the bosses and the dogs tighten the grips on the reins. But we didn't start the fire. It was always burning, and it'll keep on burning. It'll keep on burning, yeah.
Listening to From Embers, your weekly anarchist radio show on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you might be listening to the podcast edition of From Embers on your smartphone or another device. To find more content like this or get in touch with us, check us out at fromembers.libsyn.com or simply search From Embers wherever you usually get your podcasts. Here's the rest of my interview with Divest McGill.
Let's talk a bit about the current wave of occupations. Can you tell me a little bit about just what led up to those and how they got organized?
Sure. So the occupations come at the end of a long period of being purely online, as it had been mentioned, and kind of during that time, some of the kind of core pandemic organizers at Divest had been, you know, discussing, you know, what to do when we return to campus. And this had like taken kind of a variety of different forms, in particular kind of an outdoor kind of disruptive camp out had been an idea for a while with it being outdoors, with the potential of people being able to kind of join it and kind of join this kind of community feeling space. And to have that go for a while and kind of, again, feel like a community and feel kind of like a caring space. And this idea kind of morphed over time, especially with more of the focus around democratization. And kind of what came out of it was this idea of an open occupation that aims to kind of last, which means not quite the same as the disruptive occupations that we've done before in, you know, say the administration building, that kind of, you know, shut it down for a working day or stay for maybe 3 days, but ultimately remain invisible to students, and, you know, the administration doesn't tend to care all that much about them either. But switching to an open occupation where we kind of take up visible space and welcome people in and kind of envision an environment collectively that feels like it operates using direct democracy, and that kind of feels safe and caring and democratic in a way that McGill distinctly doesn't to many people.
So Divest was occupying the arts building on the downtown campus for about 2 weeks. I believe it was 12 days. Mm-hmm. And then it was taken down by the students for a few days because there was a COVID scare and we wanted to make sure that wouldn't be a major spread. And then there was a new occupation that was set up in the Burnside building for 3 days, 2 nights. And then that came to an end when people marched up to the big climate justice teach-in that was happening at the end of March. And as Mose was saying, the goal is really to create the space in which community members, be it students, being workers, be it people from the Milton Park community. We also had a lot of support from them, and they gave us some material and earplugs because there was sound torture at some point, this very high-pitched noise playing in the area where students were sleeping. So yeah, could come in the space, participate in different activities. Every day there would be one to three activities, sometime reading circles, assemblies, movie screenings, presentations from other organizing groups and campaigns, and could participate in those activities or just, you know, spend some time with other people in the space, having free food, do whatever work they needed to do in the space. And the goal was for us to create this learning community that we would like the school to be in the end, and practice, as Mose was saying, practice direct democracy, practice collective decision making, make mistakes and learn from those mistakes, and you know, be able to envision what the school could look like in the future once we do democratize. And it was a very good way for us to be able to engage with workers as well, since we were there 24 hours every day of the week. So that gave organizers a chance to have direct contact with workers that they would not necessarily run into during their, you know, normal school week when they just go to their classes and maybe stay for meetings, but, you know, ultimately leave at the end of the day. And that allowed for a good relationship building between some members of Divest or some members of the coalition and some workers in the community. And we were also able to amplify some struggles that were going on campus, particularly the floor fellow strike is one I'm thinking about. So workers in residence went on strike for a few days because their collective agreement had expired and McGill was refusing to negotiate with them. Well, they, you know, they would negotiate. I don't want to have legal actions against me, but wouldn't give very much and reduce their pay offer when the first one was rejected by the workers. And so it was really treating them with disrespect. And so since we were there and we had a table and a lot of people with, you know, energy to go flyer and sticker and poster, they gave us some material, the union for the floor fellows gave us some material that we could distribute. And we distributed a bunch of zines from other groups as well. And so it's really a space to amplify other struggles as much as to envision democratization.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds important, but also really fun. Do you feel like the pandemic itself and not being present on campus, like, led you in some ways to do a more open social thing like that? Like, is the fact that you were doing online school a contributing factor in that? To me, it just seems like people would really be craving a moment like that where you would all come together, if that makes sense.
I definitely think so. I think people within the group and people on campus needed a space where community could happen. A lot of people who started school during the pandemic have maybe not had as much of a chance to make connections on campus. A lot of students are coming from outside of Jiuzhaige, might have left their family, might have left their friends in other cities and in other countries. And the school, as it currently operates, in many, many faculty, encourages this sort of sense of competition between students, which make it hard for a lot of people to build connections. And a lot of first year students struggle with this during the first months of the school. Most, you know, eventually find the lower group of friends, but there are not a lot of spaces on campus where you can just be and meet with other people. And the pandemic has made it especially hard because there, of course, and hope, like, it's a good thing, like socially distancing rules, but it also makes it very lonely for a lot of people. And so having that space where people could come in and, you know, they would come in the morning going to their classes and then someone would welcome them in the school and give them free food and invite them to come back for an activity later on was something that was very appreciated from a lot of people. And I remember this one student that I talked to, we didn't agree on a lot of things, like on politics, but they came in and they were like, I didn't have a lunch for today. And I was coming to school and I was praying. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do for food, but I need food. And then I came in the school and you were there. And it was just so beautiful to see you there. And you know, you invited me for food and then they came back and they were in the space for a couple of days. And I think even if that had been the only thing we would have accomplished, and it's not the case, I would have been entirely satisfied with the action, because that was a very precious moment. And there have been a lot of these moments of people walking through the space and being able to find community there, which is very rare on this campus.
What are some of your goals now that these occupations have sort of wound down? Like, what do you think is next for your group, for the campus? What are you envisioning for the future?
We're currently focusing on debriefing from those actions. We have helped other campaigns in other schools start their own occupations. And we want to make sure to learn from the experiences we've had. We're thinking of maybe doing a zine, sort of Open Occupation 101 to spread that knowledge and also make sure it's written down somewhere so that when the people who are currently here graduate, hopefully we will have one before that happens, but there will be other struggles. And so we want to make sure that that knowledge is transmitted and is, archived somewhere to be kept. And so we're thinking of doing a zine over the summer to reflect on what we've learned and compile the best practices and the fun things that happen in that space. And we are also onboarding a lot of new members, both in Divest McGill and in the Democratize McGill Coalition. A lot of people who joined either during the occupation or because they heard about us during the occupation and now want to join. So making sure that they feel included in the group. And I don't know if you want to add some things on like special projects, but we're looking at potentially having like an end of the year action, and then potentially doing research during the summer for Democratize Gill.
And then so you'd mentioned other occupations that have started springing up as well, and so that's also something that I'd love to talk about because so in the as kind of our second occupation was starting up, there was also an occupation that started up at Concordia University, also here in so-called Montreal, that lasted until the end of that week, as well as and then that was followed by an occupation at UDM, the University of Montreal, and that was exciting because so they also had kind of a week full of activities, and they also had a couple of folks hunger striking for divestment and climate justice, and at the end of their kind of first week of occupation, one of their members was hospitalized. And McGill, the university actually announced divestment. And so we had this kind of, wave of three occupations, and at the end of the third one, they got a win, which I find really interesting and exciting from a movement perspective. Just the idea that, this tactic was adopted by other folks, was changed to suit, their context, and proved effective, along with other tactics used, of course. So, kind of continuing to be a resource for other folks that want to kind of try this open occupation model is, as was said, I think, a really interesting focus, as well as I'm interested in meeting up with organizers from these other groups, and like sharing strategy, and kind of continuing this momentum forward as well.
So I kind of wanted to ask you guys, like, it's hard sometimes for student organizing to continue even like over the summer. I know you guys must be getting close to exam season now, let alone like between generations when people graduate. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to talk a bit about like your vision for that or your plans for that. I'm kind of struck in this conversation by like actually like how similar a lot of the things you guys are doing are to things that happened like when I was on campus. But like, of course, in student time, that's like a really long time ago, and we don't talk to each other. but I wonder how you plan to sort of keep that campaign moving forward. Presumably, like, I could imagine McGill divesting from fossil fuels, but something like transforming the university into a space that feels more like that occupation would like it would take more than 4 years most likely. So like, how is that possible? How do you imagine that happening?
That's why we focus a lot on recruitment every year, and it was difficult during the pandemic, but I think we did a good job this year, and that's exactly because of that problem of turnover in the student body. And I am very happy to say that we have a lot of first year and second year students who joined the group this year and are very active. And so I'm not too worried about the future and about making sure that the group is able to transmit the knowledge and doesn't just disappear. One thing we have struggled with a little bit and are trying to get better at is just sharing knowledge within the group. Sometimes we have sharing circles and we'll pick a topic, for example, security culture, and then everyone sort of shares knowledge that they have on the issue. Sometimes we'll invite someone to come over. We often do that for more legal things, so know your rights training. We also had a security liaison training, and that ensures that people within the group are able to learn all the skills they want to learn, and share that knowledge when they become the older member and welcome new members in. We also have this thing called a buddy system, where we pair up new members who want to participate in that system with members that have been here for a longer period of time, usually more than a semester, then that allows for a more personal connection within the group. And the buddy system exists so that knowledge gets transmitted. So if there are things that are brought up during a meeting and are not really explained, and the person, you know, doesn't feel comfortable raising their hand to ask a question during the meeting, but, you know, has questions after the meeting, they can reach out to their buddy and ask all the questions. And then the buddy hopefully has the answers and can sort of transmit that knowledge to the newer member. And we also have on our internal platform a channel called No Such Thing as a Stupid Question, I believe is the name, where people can also ask all sort of questions about the campaign, about organizing, about climate justice, whatever they need, you know, input on, and knowledge gets transmitted that way. So those are sort of the strategies we've been implementing, or tactics we've been implementing for knowledge transmission. As far as staying active during the summer, in the past 2 years, we had organizers from the group participate in a fellowship with Divest Ed, which is an organization based in the States, which supports fossil fuel divestment campaigns, but also prison industrial complex divestment / abolition campaigns. And so participate in that fellowship, sort of continue doing research for the group, create a particular project, and then bring that back to the group in the fall. And another thing we did last year, and I'm hoping we will do this year, is sort of just have a document with like a spreadsheet with all of the members of the group, what their capacity looks like during the summer, what sort of projects they want to be working on, and whether or not they are available to work on projects with Divest, whether they want to do so or not. And then members who decide to be working on Divest projects over the summer are able to sort of contact each other and know who is still around for the summer, who is not, who can I message if I need like a really quick answer for something, like who do I reach out to have a meeting. And yeah, I think it made it really useful, really easy for us to connect last summer. So I'm hoping we do that this year as well.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I guess I'm almost done here, but I was wondering if you could talk a bit, like, I think campus organizing is like a very particular thing that we do for, like, you know, often only a few years of our lives, but also for many of us, it ends up, I think, being quite formative. Like, it's like, it can be, I think, like a springboard for people to get involved in all kinds of other similar issues and campaigns, like beyond McGill or beyond their university. I don't know if you each can talk a bit about what you have personally gained from your participation in this campaign or in the occupations, like what you got out of doing that, like as a person who was there. I think sometimes we underestimate how inspiring moments like that where we all camp out together can be. So I just kind of want to give a chance to speak about that as well.
You know, I remember coming into Divest in first year and being kind of, you know, quite shy and not super confident, you know, as an organizer, as a social being. And yeah, since then, I guess I've just kind of like learned a lot in terms of, you know, skills and navigating spaces. And, you know, this occupation is definitely one of them where it is and purports to be, you know, a kind of like different sort of experience from a lot of spaces, in the fact that it is communal, you know, people share food in a communal fashion, and it just, you know, tries to fight the isolation that emerged throughout the pandemic, and that has been present in some way or another, you know, on campuses kind of for a while. So yeah, just kind of.
We pledge resistance.
What's up? This is Saul Williams chilling here in Montreal, here on CKUT. Peace.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgehaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgehaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Segun kanasada ke hronus kana kuva. Ne katiwa hikiko, ne oska te wan yawe tan oska yutsto kore zaat FM se wa damsate, kanasada ke kari huwa nahta. Ne katiwa hikiko ne wahni tion yu waksanoto, kwekun watkwan huerda.